Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Nick Redfern. He has been on the program before. He was last with me in April 2010 when we discussed his book, The NASA Conspiracies. In fact, Nick is probably well known to you. He's quite a prolific author. And like me and many other people, he loves a good mystery, except in Nick's case, he likes to know what is at the root of the mystery, which is why we are going to discuss his latest book called The Real Men in Black. So welcome to the program, Nick.
Well, thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, you're very welcome. Now, the name in itself, Men in Black, and I gather they often arrive in black cars, sounds rather threatening. What are they really? I mean, are they a danger or something to be avoided?
Well, you know, I mean, the Men in Black mystery is a kind of a weird one. I'm sure most people, you know, have heard of the Men in Black, whether they're interested in UFOs or not, and primarily because of the, you know, the Hollywood movies starring Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones of the same name. And there's actually a third Men in Black movie slated to come out next year. So I think, you know, there's no doubt that there's people recognize the terminology and understand that it's sort of connected with sort of shadowy people going around allegedly silencing UFO witnesses. And, you know, as strange and as bizarre and as controversial as it sounds, you know, there are numerous people who have made such claims. And so when I was sort of scouting around for new ideas for books to write, you know, I was sort of going through my old files and records that I'd got from people and, you know, realized that there was a substantial amount of material on the Men in Black and theories as well on the Men in Black that had never been published before. And I thought, well, because many people either view this as, you know, just like a Hollywood issue or something from the early years of ufology that's just not around anymore, I thought, why not try and, you know, bring it to an audience, a new audience, and demonstrate, you know, the Men in Black are very real, hence the title of the book. And, you know, in answer to your question, you know, there are a lot of very sort of almost hostile and malevolent reports of people encountering the Men in Black.
Right. So what is it that they are actually trying to hide up?
Well, you know, I mean, these are sort of questions like that are the significant ones. I mean, it's clear that most people who've had encounters with the Men in Black or been silenced or threatened, or in most cases, it's not like a like an outright threat. It's almost like a veiled threat, you know, where it's like, well, did that person just threaten me or didn't they? You know, they kind of let people put the dots together, so to speak. And most of it seems to be centered around UFOs. You know, if somebody is getting a little bit too close to something sensitive, they get this weird and ominous visit from these guys in black suits who, you know, bang on the door late at night and very often turn up in groups of three. And it tends essentially intimidate the person until they either stay silent or in some cases, you know, they just outright quit the UFO subject. And so I think it's not a case that, you know, the MIB will appear in, you know, just everyday cases of lights in the sky or even in most cases. I think it's where someone uncovers something very close to the truth, whatever that might be. And then it's those people who kind of get a visit. So I think most of it centers around ensuring that whatever lies at the heart of the UFO mystery, if somebody stumbles upon it inadvertently or otherwise, then they kind of pop up and sort of show their face.
Right. Do you think that it might mainly revolve around the fact that the US government has back-engineered ET craft and built some of their own, which clearly must be seen in the skies at different times? Is it that people get a little bit too close to finding out that there are craft of their own?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that can obviously come into it. I think it's sort of the overall UFO mystery, whether it's, you know, like our UFOs or their UFOs or whoever's UFOs. And I think it can, you know, it can relate to sort of classified aircraft, you know, US-developed technology. I think it can relate to abductions. You know, there's so many different strands of the UFO subject that I think from speaking to the witness. I mean, for example, I've spoken to witnesses who were visited by the Men in Black, who investigated everything from abduction stories to contactee cases to even people who are looking into things like the Mothman mystery. So in other words, it seems it's not just linked to, you know, back engineered technology, which is an entirely feasible angle anyway, but also, you know, with respect to all aspects of the UFO subject, not just one or two.
Now, that's interesting that you mentioned the Mothman. I think that goes back a long time. Are you seriously suggesting that there's something there that they want to hide?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look back, for example, a number of, you know, the Mothman Prophecies was made into a 2002 movie with Hollywood movie with Richard Gere. But if you go back to John Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies, on which the which the movie was based, Keel was someone who was at the forefront of carrying out investigations where Mothman was seen in the mid-1960s in this town called Point Pleasant. That's what West Virginia. That's actually what the movie's based on, all these weird sightings in and around Point Pleasant from about 65 to 67. And another author who also wrote a book on the Mothman story, although a lesser-known book, but which, to my mind, is actually better than John Keel's book, is called The Silver Bridge, written by Gray Barker. And it's called The Silver Bridge because the Mothman presence in Point Pleasant actually sort of culminated in the collapse of the town's Silver Bridge, which led to dozens of people drowning when their cars fell into the water off the bridge when it collapsed into the Ohio River and they drowned. And various people kind of saw Mothman's presence as somehow being connected with the deaths, or possibly they perceived it as being like a warning creature rather than actually being the cause of it. But as both Keel and Barker pointed out in their books, written in the 70s and the 60s respectively, when the Mothman sightings were at their height in and around Point Pleasant, there were countless reports of men in black. A number of these reports came from a local journalist named Mary Heyer, who was like a newspaper stringer in the area at the time. And she talked about a number of very weird and ominous encounters with men in black who basically came into the newspaper offices late at night and again sort of issued these veiled threats. They would say things like, you know, what would you do if somebody told you not to talk about flying saucers? And she said, I'd tell them to go to hell. And, you know, so it was kind of like when she stood up against them, then they backed down. But very often people don't back down. They kind of just crumble and, you know, say, okay, I won't say anything about it.
They get scared, in other words.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, this is the thing about the important thing about the Men in Black. If, you know, if people are of like a weak-willed character, then the tactics of the Men in Black unfortunately work. If you stand up to them, you know, they kind of back away. So it's almost, you know, that the threat is implied. But unless you, for example, actually, you know, if you're willing to go along with what they say, then they're satisfied that you're going to remain silent. When people stand up to them, you know, it's very rarely that the story go, or that the events go any further. You know, they back away as if to say, you know, they've been kind of trumped themselves, as if, you know, outright threats and even death, you know, isn't on the cards. It's almost like they just want to instill the fear in you and hope you'll just shut up or whatever.
Right. Now, as far as I can recall, that particular Mothman is in fact quite unique as far as sightings are concerned. Have you ever been able to discover where the Mothman came from or why he was here or she?
Well, you know, nobody has really. I mean, although, you know, certainly in the past, if you look back at the stuff that was published in the 60s and 70s about Mothman, so the prevailing theory was that Mothman was some sort of Grim Reaper type character or something that actually caused the collapse of the bridge in the town that killed all these people, and that its presence was literally like some sort of Grim Reaper type character. Today, that view has very much changed, and many researchers of the Mothman phenomenon kind of view Mothman as not the cause behind disasters, but actually that it kind of surfaces to try and warn people when disasters are looming. In other words, it's some sort of paranormal entity that isn't actually responsible for these events, but somehow has an awareness of what's, you know, disasters that are coming in the future, and tries to warn people whose minds might be receptive to understanding the message that, you know, disasters on the cards. I mean, people point out that, you know, there have been reports of Mothman in connection with other disasters around the world, where, you know, the creature's been seen beforehand. So, you know, you have a lot of theories, but nobody really has been able to pinpoint, you know, what it is or where it comes from. Only that when certain disasters have occurred, people have reported seeing these sort of large human-like winged creatures, almost like gargoyles, kind of looming in the shadows and the darkness, and, you know, kind of showing themselves to certain people as if to try and get a message across.
I must say, speaking personally, I would certainly go along with the idea that it was some paranormal exhibition rather than that it was some kind of extraterrestrial. It doesn't somehow seem to quite fit the idea of people visiting the Earth.
Oh, no, you're right, it doesn't.
Now, I know from your previous visit that you have visited the Roswell site. Say, whilst you were there, because the wreckage was spread over a massive area, that you found a reasonably substantial piece of the craft. If it became known that you had that, do you think that's the sort of thing the Men in Black would be after you for?
I'm sure they would. I mean, I think, you know, the important thing to look at is that there seems to be two categories of men in black. There are very weird men in black, which we can kind of get into, that actually don't even seem human. But there's also this category of men in black where there are people in government who, you know, are sitting on the sort of the deeper, darker UFO secrets and will do whatever it takes to keep them under wraps. And, you know, if we look back into the early years of ufology, particularly with things like Roswell, you know, we hear a lot of stories about some of the locals who lived in the area and who might have scooped up bits of wreckage from the crash site before the military got there, or that the military simply overlooked, you know, when they were cleaning the site up, etc., who were later visited and threatened, you know, you'll hand this over in the name of national security if you're a good patriot, etc. And, of course, back in those days, you know, the military comes knocking on your front door, or the FBI, whoever, you know, you're going to listen to them, you know, and you're going to, the people would hand over the materials. Now, you know, back then they wore sort of the black, you know, the FBI or whoever, they wore the black suits and the gangster type hats, etc. So they looked like the typical imagery of the men in black. So, you know, you could argue that they are the men in black, but, you know, there are other categories of men in black as well. But I there's absolutely no doubt, you know, that if, you know, I think for most people in ufology who do UFO research, that to an extent, I think a lot of people are sort of clandestinely watched by government agencies. But unfortunately, unless you have the hard evidence, which equally unfortunately most of us don't, you know, we're nothing more than just a person of interest, you know, at a low level. But that low level could be elevated massively overnight if you uncovered something where some old timer from Roswell phoned you up and said, you know, my grandfather kept this piece of wreckage for 60 years. Now I want to hand it over to somebody. That would possibly elevate it to a greater level where you potentially could get threatened, because that's the one thing that I think the men in black seem more prevalent to focus upon, is when somebody has hard evidence. You know, unfortunately, even I have to admit that if we have lots of accounts, lots of stories, lots of witness testimony, that's great. You know, the witnesses are the most important people in the subject. But if we don't have the hard evidence, unfortunately, the government doesn't have to worry, because they can just deny the stories. So I think that's why we have accounts of men in black turning up more in accounts, in stories where there's some sort of hard evidence, because they know that could sort of blow the thing wide open.
I recall in a documentary I saw about the Roswell crash, and it seemed to be very well edited and contained a lot of interviews with witnesses. There was a nurse who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and she was in this hospital room, I think it was, when bodies of the ETs were brought in, and she, strictly speaking, wasn't meant to see it. And it gave the impression that she was so scared that it looks as though they considered her to be a very unstable person. And she was not only warned off, but apparently she disappeared. I don't know if she ever surfaced anywhere later, but it seems to me that when the Men in Black or the government or whoever's behind it find something like that, they will go to any extent to silence the witness.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that sort of speaks volumes of the fact that why for the most part people don't get visited, because we don't have evidence. You know, it's unfortunate, and it doesn't help my position to admit this, but I have to admit it, that no matter how much research we do, no matter how much credible evidence from the witnesses we get, unless we have hard evidence, the government actually is still in a position of control, because, you know, that they can just say, oh, well, it's just a story. And when people say, no, it isn't, they say, well, prove it. And unfortunately, no matter how credible the witness is, you cannot prove it without hard evidence. And that's why I think sort of the Men in Black stories are sort of few and far between, because they really only do come out of the woodwork when the stakes are that high, when somebody really might have something that could sort of tip the scales. And that would make sense. You know, Men in Black or government people aren't going to turn up on somebody's doorstep just because John Smith happened to see a blue light in the sky last Thursday and told you about it. You know, that's not any reason for anybody to be silenced or intimidated. It's when we get closer to the mystery that I think people, you know, become more of like a subject of interest.
Right. You mentioned the government there. Do you think they are actually behind the Men in Black? I mean, it would seem to make logic to me, but what do you think?
Well, in some cases it does, because the Freedom of Information Act has shown that in some cases where people have said they've been visited by, you know, guys in dark suits who kind of intimidated them and asked them to turn over photographs and drawings they'd made and things like that, there's actually a number of documents have surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act where now we can actually trace back those stories to, for example, people like Air Force Intelligence and the FBI. I mean, that's a fact. You know, we've got the files in the public domain. Now, that's sort of one aspect of the Men in Black mystery. Why that particular angle becomes sort of compounded and controversial is because there's actually another aspect to the Men in Black mystery, and that's that although the people, largely, I think, due to things like the Hollywood movies like the Men in Black, you know, they perceive the Men in Black as all being sort of government agents sent out by some super secret, deeply buried agency, which I actually do believe is a part of the mystery. The problem is, however, that most reports of the Men in Black don't fall into that category at all. Most reports, the witnesses describe the MIB as kind of looking only like 5 feet tall, with sort of very pale, almost like white skin, you know, to the point of being anemic. They look kind of anorexic almost, you know, just massively skinny. They have these bulging eyes that they hide behind wraparound sunglasses, and they almost kind of look like half-human, half-alien hybrids trying to, I guess, infiltrate us and move amongst us by only sort of surfacing late at night, staying in the shadows, wearing these trench coats with pulled-up collars, wraparound glasses, and pulled-down hats, as if to try and hide as much as possible of their real identity. And, you know, if it was just one or two cases like that we have on record where people said that, we could write them off. But the ironic thing is that's actually the category that most people talk about with the Men in Black. The Hollywood imagery of like the Will Smith, Tommy Lee Jones, secret agent Men in Black, they're actually in the minority. The vast majority are these weirder, creepy, menacing, as I said, skinny, pale-faced, bulging eyes Men in Black, which again has led some people to think that there's, and I think quite correctly, to conclude that there's two category of Men in Black. There's the government angle, and then there's something else that is possibly directly related to the UFO phenomenon itself.
Yes, well, from your description, it would certainly seem to indicate that we may be looking at some ETs like the Greys.
Mm.
Yes,
I mean, you know, people talk a lot about, you know, the whole issue of alien-human hybrids. Well, you know, if that scenario is true, there's probably not a better example of that that might fall into that category than the Men in Black. You know, they look human at first glance, but if you take a closer look at them, there's something, you know, a lot of things very weird about them. You know, as I said, they're, you know, just pale white skin, even the men. For example, Mary Heyer, who lived in Point Pleasant, the journalist I was talking about, she had several visits from these MIB-type characters, and she said, you know, most of them were only like 5 feet tall, and they seemed to have, like, lifts in the shoes to make them that tall, as if they'd only be sort of like 4 foot ten, and, you know, they had these oddly spaced eyes, and they didn't seem fully conversant with our ways and mannerisms. And there was something just really unearthly about them. Now, you know, if you look at, for example, stories of alien-human hybrids that have been circulated for the last sort of 20, 30 years, the idea of some sort of genetic program going on with aliens, you know, researchers like, for example, Dr. David Jacobs have spoken about the idea that could the aliens be creating like a half-human, half-hybrid race that could infiltrate us? You know, they look enough like us to where, unless you look at them too closely, you know, they could move amongst us. You know, there are a few subtle differences here and there, but not that many. And certainly, if that's true, then the Men in Black would really fit into that category, I think.
Now, one can't expect you to give away every secret that's in your book that you've revealed.
Oh, I don't care. I can talk about it all. I'm not one of these who... No, actually, that annoys me when authors... there's nothing worse to me than when an author says, well, it's all in the book, by the book. I cannot stand that. You know, I think that's arrogant, and it's lazy, and it's just telling people, buy my book, you know. No, I mean, you know, my view is that if I've got information, I'll share it. I'm not in the business of being some sort of like a used car salesman or whatever.
Oh, well, that's wonderful, because all I was really going to say was that you said that you've learnt quite a bit from secret government files, and I wondered if you'd like to sort of give us a view of the type of information that you found.
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the ones, a very interesting one, back in the mid-1990s, I interviewed a woman named Anne Henson. And Anne lived in Somerset, England. And this her case began in, or occurred, I should say, in 1962. And Anne, at the time, was living on a dairy farm that her parents owned in Somerset. And she was woken up in the early hours of one particular morning, looked out the window, and there was like a large hill that overlooked the farm that her parents owned. And it's like a very rural area in Somerset, and... she saw this strange light hovering that started to do sort of bizarre maneuvers in the sky, sort of zipping back and forth, etc. And this actually went on for like 3 or 4 nights altogether. It was just bizarre. The object sort of came and went and over a period of time. And so what Anne did, she was a teenager at the time, as I said, living in a parent's farm. She contacted a local Air Force base and just said, you know, I've seen this weird thing. Do you have any idea what it is? She forgot about it for a few days afterwards, but then late one night, a week or two later, there was a knock at the door, literally like 9 o'clock at night. And it was a guy dressed in a black suit and tie, not like a military uniform, black suit and tie, who turned up in a black car and essentially invited himself in and said, you know, I've come to talk to you about your UFO encounter. And of course, Anne, you know, only a... sort of her late teens at the time, was sort of kind of worried and intimidated a bit by the fact that she was getting the visit from, well, whoever, you know. And the two of them sat down together and told me, when I personally interviewed her, and she said that, you know, he was asked all sorts of questions about the encounter, and Anne told him how she'd done drawings of the object in the sky, and had also taken compass readings and things like that. And the guy said, well, you know, can I take them with me to get them analyzed? And she said, yeah, and he promised to bring them back. And, of course, she never did get them back, which is a staple part of Men in Black stories, where they confiscate evidence, etc. And again, he made, I won't say a threat, but he made a veiled comment that sort of convinced not to talk about it. He actually said along the lines of, well, no one's going to believe you, what you've just told me, so there's no point mentioning it to anybody. Do you understand? You know, it was like that. And she did understand to where, you know, she decided not to say anything. And, you know, in many respects, this is a very interesting story, but it would just remain like a classic Men in Black case that, despite the high credibility of the witness, which Anne certainly is a very credible witness, it would just remain a case that we would be unable to verify or confirm. But where Anne's story becomes important is because just a few years ago, under the terms of the British government's Freedom of Information Act, the Ministry of Defence declassified into the public domain several hundred pages of documents dating from 1962, which is the year of Anne's experience. And the file itself actually contains the official report on Anne's encounter. And it talks about how, you know, a representative of the military went to her house and interviewed, and the entire file is there confirming everything she said. What's interesting is that Anne's man in black was actually a Sergeant J.W. Scott, who was attached to an arm of the British Royal Air Force called the Provost and Security Services. Now, the Provost and Security Services aren't like the regular Air Force. They're kind of like the James Bonds of the Air Force. They deal with national security issues, espionage, counterintelligence programs, things like this. And it was this one of these guys, Sergeant Scott, who actually came out to interview Anne. So in other words, you know, we have cases like this where today we have the official records that confirm, you know, that somebody has been visited. It vindicates the story. And we even have the person's name, you know, in the file. And the fact that he wasn't just a regular guy, you know, working at the local Air Force base, he was someone trained in espionage and counterintelligence operations, sort of makes the story even more intriguing in terms of the fact that, you know, this is how the MIB work. You know, they're kind of like guys trained in espionage and counterintelligence. You know, they sort of operate like spies. They come out of the shadows. They ask intimidating questions. You know, they don't give up their identity. And then before you know it, they're walking out the front door and they've got all the information they need, and you've spilled your beans, and, you know, they're gone. So.
Mm. Very interesting. Now, I should think people who follow the UFO subject are hardly unlikely to have heard of Billy Meyer and know of his brilliant photographs. Now, somebody like that who has become so well known, yet at the same time, I think, was often threatened or intimidated, and he said was tried. They tried to assassinate him on many occasions. Do you think they can get to the point where they become so well known that they can't really take any serious action against them because of the publicity that might arise?
Oh yeah, I mean, I always say to people, you know, if you've had a significant UFO experience, and maybe you've had like some sort of intimidation from the Men in Black, or, you know, you've had weird, as some people talk about, weird telephone interference, or your mail's arrived late, you know, it's been opened and resealed as if evidence that you're being watched, I always encourage people to go public, because the time to worry is when you're actually in the shadows and not saying anything, because if anything happens to you then, nobody's going to know. If you go public with your story on a wide scale, no one's going to touch you then, because if anything happened and it was like a suspicious silencing, or worse still, a suspicious death, then people are going to look at it and dig into it. And that's the very last thing anybody in the official world would want, that they want people keeping away from these stories. So in other words, the more public and visual you are, the less chance you have of anything happening to you, I think.
Hmm. Do you think that applies to you? Does that situation apply to you? Because you're obviously quite well known in the UFO world.
Well, I mean, again, I think it depends on your character. I mean, for example, you know, people who are sort of a bit, you know, weak-minded or easily frightened or whatever, they probably would stay silent. I think possibly why I've not had any intimidation or visit is because, you know, if somebody visited me and said, stay silent about this or else, as soon as they left, I'd just blog it. I'd blog it all across the internet, you know, and that would backfire. So I think they do psychological profiles on people before they decide to what extent, you know, they would silence them. And if somebody is proven to have a character where, you know, they're kind of weak-willed and they back down and whatever, well, they're the perfect person to be targeted if they come across something significant. You know, if on the other hand, you know, as I said, I would blog it and put it in the next book, and I'd probably, you know, set up a tape. You know, if I had a chance, if I saw them pull it coming up the drive, I'd just set up a portable tape recorder in the room and record the entire conversation and just, you know, put it on YouTube or whatever for everybody to download. So I think, you know, the realization would be there, well, there are certain people who it's not a good idea to visit. So I think it doesn't just necessarily revolve around the extent to which you have UFO data that they might need to silence you. It's also dependent upon your character as whether they can actually succeed in silencing you or not.
Hmm. You're a bit of a rebel then, really, Nick, aren't you?
Well, I don't think it's being a rebel. I think it's just that people should stand up for themselves, you know, when put in an awkward situation. You know, it would be the same thing if, you know, I got a speeding ticket and I knew I wasn't speeding.
Yes.
You know, I would stand up for that.
I don't blame you. I think I'm
I don't just apply that to UFOs. I mean, I actually did that once over here. I got a speeding ticket, and I argued against it, and I found the judge in the little town where I got done for speeding, and the ticket was dropped. You know, it's like if you stand up and make your point.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you have to do. Governments don't want people to stand up and make their point. They want people to sit at home, watch reality TV, go to work, and not think about things. You know, and that doesn't just apply to UFOs. That applies to everything. So, you know, I encourage people to question everything and demonstrate and protest if things are going on that you don't like. I go on a lot of protests, you know, and I don't care. You know, I don't protest for the sake of protesting. I protest if I see something going down that I don't like, you know, and I think everybody should do that.
Yes, indeed. Now, in the UFO world again, Stephen Greer's work and his attempts to get disclosure announced have made him obviously extremely well known, and he is in a way encouraging many military personnel or the likes to go as far as they can without actually breaking their oath. Do you think that he is sort of insulated in that way because of what he knows?
Oh, yeah, I think, you know, Stephen Greer has done a huge amount of very good work, you know, in terms of bringing forth people from the military, the intelligence community, the government, talking about their UFO experiences, you know, at these press conferences and different events he's put on where, you know, he's had people in their hundreds literally come forward, you know, who talk about classified UFO events they were involved in. But I think, you know, the ironic thing is that despite the massive amounts of very solid and very good controversial data that Stephen Greer has brought forth, he's actually protecting himself from any sort of incurring any sort of wrath because of the fact that he is so publicly visible. You know, that's the thing. I don't believe anything untoward or sinister will happen to Stephen Greer because he's so much in the public domain that if it did happen, everybody and his brother would be on the trail of trying to determine what had happened to him. You know, as I said, it really is the case that if you're sitting on top of really hot data and no one knows, that's the time to worry. The time not to worry is when you're splashed all over the newspapers. Then you are pretty much safe, I think.
Right. Yes, I think in Stephen's case, he's done it in a very clever way, and no doubt in time he will get the authorization to release what he knows. I was surprised to find, and I doubt whether you would be, that in fact the US government actually have consulted him on the UFO subject.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, this isn't necessarily surprising. I mean, there has over the years been kind of like a to and fro between, you know, people within government and the UFO community. You know, it's not like it's an us you know, type of scenario where it's us against them, etc., and vice versa. One of the things that I've found over the years is, you know, that I think government agencies, you know, it's not like they're all working to one agenda. You know, it's like whatever happened at Roswell, somebody is hiding the facts. There's no doubt about that. You know, somewhere the old files from 64 years ago probably still exist somewhere, and somebody's sitting on them. But that doesn't mean there aren't other agencies that are following their own agendas with respect to UFOs. It's, you know, everybody talks about UFOs are being hidden by the government, as if the government is just one unified body. That isn't the case. You know, there are different agencies with different agendas. And I think some of them, who may not be fully conversant with the full facts, have at times, you know, spoken to people in the UFO research community to try and get a better handle on what's going on. And they've even recruited them, you know, to get help. I mean, you have to look at the situation of Bill Moore, who in the wake of the publication of his book, The Roswell Incident, you know, was basically brought into, you know, contact with a number of people in the intelligence community who shared information on Roswell and UFOs and classified incidents and things like this. You know, they were looking to get the word out to kind of subtly prepare people for the truth. Others, you know, had a completely different agenda along the lines of, there's no way, you know, we're going to tell people this ever. So, you know, I think it's far more of a subtle situation. It doesn't surprise me that people may have been approached and asked for advice or, you know, we want to use you to get information out, whereas others are saying, no, you know, this is ridiculous. We cannot tell people. And agencies are arguing between each other almost as to what approach to take.
Right. Now, there is a whole mountain of information about UFOs and sightings and contacts. But having said all that, do you think, by and large, the public are ready for disclosure?
Well, that's kind of dependent on what disclosure is. You know, it's like when people, you know, I actually have a lot of sympathy for people who are involved in the disclosure movement, because in terms of what they're doing, you know, they're actually doing something worthwhile. They're trying to get the facts out to, you know, to people as to what it all means, etc., and what's going on. But if it's just a case of, you know, saying the disclosure is, well, yes, UFOs exist. One crashed in Roswell in the summer of 1947, and we've hidden it from you, but we've decided to tell you the truth, etc., etc. If that's all disclosure is, then people would be ready for it because, well, you know, it's like 64 years ago, aliens crashed, and okay, the government hid it, but we'll forgive them. They had their reasons. If that's all disclosure is, yeah, people will be ready for it because that's not a big deal. What people won't be ready for is if the issue of whether or not there's more disturbing data that's being withheld. You know, people always paint the government as the bad guys for withholding the information, but it would be ironic if the real story came tumbling out and it was so dark and disturbing that we might have been better off not knowing. You know, it's like, for example, you take alien abduction stories. Well, you know, it's like if you look at it in simplistic terms or black and white terms, people say, oh, well, abductions are occurring because, you know, the aliens are sort of involved in some sort of, you know, genetic experiment to sort of save their race or whatever, because they're on the, genetically speaking, their last legs. You know, they need an injection of new blood. But the harsh reality is that if that is going on, what's happening is that human beings are being kidnapped against their will and used in genetic experiments about which they're told it's for everybody's good, but nobody can prove that. Now, you know, if the government was to come forward and say disclosure is that aliens are flying around, they're using us in genetic experiments, and sorry, we cannot stop it, we're powerless to do anything about it, and we don't have control of our skies, if that's disclosure, people probably wouldn't be ready for it. So, you know, in other words, I think whether people are ready for disclosure or not is dependent upon what disclosure is. You know, it's kind of like saying, you know, a woman can't be a little bit pregnant. It's like you can't have a little bit of disclosure. If you're going to disclose, it's all going to come tumbling out. And there's no doubt that there are some unsettling aspects to the UFO phenomenon. and I'm not convinced that everybody really is ready for it. And a significant percentage of the population might well say, you know, that I wish we'd never been told. You know, they may well say that.
I personally would think that the shocks would come if it was revealed, as I believe is the case, and I'm sure you do, that over a long period of time, the heads of governments have been contacted by space beings for various reasons, and they have had regular contact and agreed in the case of the Greys that they could have a base, or perhaps more than one, on the Earth. I think that type of information or things that have been taking place would certainly cause people to be, well, not just surprised, but shocked. Do you think that would be really a step too far for them?
What, if people found out that that was actually what was going on, you mean?
Yes, and that it's been hidden up for so long.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I think the whole issue of people being kidnapped and the government possibly not, or governments not being able to do anything about it, I think that would concern people. I think the idea that these things are coming here and skulking around in the middle of the night, spying on missile bases and shutting down nuclear launch codes is the type of stories we've heard. You know, that's kind of ominous. You know, it's like people, many people view the UFO presence as a positive one. But I always ask people, tell me one thing that aliens might have done on our planet that's positive. I can't think of one. Have they solved the problems of overpopulation? No. Cancer? No. Global warming? No. You know, deforestation of the rainforest, have they prevented that from happening? No. Have they prevented the massive amount of increase in the last few years of diabetes and obesity? No. What have they done? I cannot think of a single positive thing other than use us as a breeding mechanism, if that's what's going on, to save their race. So I think people actually have a right, and it's understandable that they would be concerned, you know, that governments might have an awareness of all this, and they may have an awareness that there are bases here, there, or wherever on the world, on our planet, and yet we're not getting anything back from it. You know, I could understand the government's position if I was seeing something tangible that not wasn't just helping the government, but that was helping everybody. But I don't see anything. All I see is more and more overpopulation. You know, temperatures are clearly changing around the world. Resources are running out. The population's growing by the minute. And we're spiraling into, like, you know, a sort of a situation where we may not last more than a couple of centuries, you know. And so disclosure may be that someone's using us, but they could care less about us until, you know, all our resources, whether it's literal resources or us as resources, you know, are exhausted.
Well, I have to say that where contact has been made with some of the space beings, they do say that within the laws of the universe, there is an element of free will. And if they did things without our permission, that would be viewed as interference. And they are not allowed to interfere with the evolution of a civilization like ours. So if that were true, that might explain why, on the face of it, you can make the observations you have about these illnesses and other aspects that we would love somebody to clear up.
But then, yeah, but the important thing, I think, is that, you know, you point out they're not allowed to interfere with our evolution. But to my eyes, we're not evolving. We're actually now on a slippery slide downwards. You know, I can understand if they felt we were evolving and becoming more advanced, whether spiritually, technologically, or whatever. But we're actually on the downside. You know, the fact is resources, mineral resources, oil resources are getting scarcer. You know, people's health is getting worse. The weather is changing for the worse. You know, there's nothing changing for the positive in the way that the human civilization is advancing. Population is increasing and food supplies and water supplies are getting less. That should be the time, if they care about us, that's not when we're evolving. We're now we've peaked. I'm absolutely convinced about that. And so why aren't they helping us? If we could, as a human race, you know, everybody recognizes that the weather's changing for the worse and there's strange things going on in the world. Everybody recognizes that. And even if these entities do, you know, why are they not intervening now? You know,
that's well, what as I said, I think that is the problem for them. It's viewed as interference and they won't do it. But I think where evolution is concerned, it's over thousands and thousands of years.
Well,
and
well,
we create our own reality. So I think if you take two steps back, it's up to you again to then start moving forward again. And I think this is how we learn, through these experiences. And you're right, we're in a pretty awful stage at the moment.
No, I agree with it. We are. And I think, you know, it's like, you know, we should learn ourselves, because it's kind of like, you know, somebody who's 50 years old living in his mum's attic or whatever, you know, never left home and or whatever, you know, that you don't challenge yourself, you don't advance or develop. And if you have an advanced race upon whom you're reliant, then you'd be like that. And of course, history on our planet's shown that when any advanced culture goes to a country where the people are less technologically advanced, they suffer. You know, you only have to look when the English went to Australia, you know, what happened to the Aborigines, how their culture suffered, and the same with the Native American Indians. They suffered, you know, with the British, you know, when you had the essentially, you know, when Britain had its own, you know, sort of, I won't say new world order, but you know, when we were in countries like India, etc., you know, those cultures, you know, suffered and things like that. So I can understand why races from out there might keep away from us, but on the other hand, the fact that they won't get involved when we're not involving, when things are actually on a downslide, suggests to me, despite what they might say, they don't have our best interests at heart. They're best basically using us as a resource. And when we either destroy ourselves or we just spiral down into, you know, global warming and no more food and slowly, you know, the world slowly disintegrates to nothingness, then they'll move on to the next world. You know, it's kind of like, you know, telling us, oh, well, everything's going to be well and good and we're your friends. And then how many planets could they have done that on, you know, theoretically in the past? It could have been thousands. You know, we're just a resource. It's kind of like, you know, the farmer with the cows in the field. The farmer, to the cow's perspective, the farmer is the greatest person because, you know, he gives them a shelter to live in. He feeds them. You know, he gives them nice grass to live on and water. And then at night they go back to the, you know, the shelter, not realizing the bigger picture of why he's actually nurturing them, and that's, you know, for food and money. That's his business. You know, maybe that's the same thing. We perceive them as being friendly because they're telling people, oh, you're the wonderful human race, we're here to help you. Well, you know, if we're anything to go by, why should they be any different to us?
Well, I don't share your views about the future, because I think it's bright and we will at some stage be uplifted. But there we are.
It's good that we have these debates, you know. I mean,
oh, yes,
I wouldn't say I'm pessimistic. I kind of view me as someone who's realistic. You know, I do believe there are people who want us to get out of the situation that the world is in right now, in every sense, whatever it might be. But the fact is that every species that's come before us, in some respects, has evolved, has risen, and then has become extinct, or, you know, that things have moved on to another species. You know, you look at the dinosaurs, mammoths, saber-toothed tigers. You know, they all had their time, and then they were gone. You know, it's only the human race's arrogance that, oh, my God, you know, we're the human race, we can't vanish, you know, we're humans, you know. Well, why not? Why shouldn't we be just like every other creature that's come before us, and then something else will take our place? You know, I don't feel it's important that the human race continues. You know, that's nature. It's just the way of the game. So.
Well, certainly not as it is, but I do honestly believe that there will be an upliftment in the very near future. But as they say, only time will tell. Now, just a quickie here, because believe it or not, we've only got a couple of minutes or so left. Do you think that if people are trying to get to the truth, say, about NASA's shady side or what goes on in Area 51, and I know you're well up on those two subjects, that they would put themselves at risk?
I think they will only put themselves at risk if they have hard evidence of something. And that's the problem. You know, it's like we have the stories of people like Bob Lazar in Area 51. All numerous right. people have written about, you know, books and articles about Bob Lazar. None of them have been silenced, and the reason is because not only do they not have the goods, but Bob Lazar wasn't able to deliver the goods either. Let's say hypothetically tomorrow a new Bob Lazar comes along from Area 51 named John Smith, and John Smith has actually smuggled out to researcher, you know, Bill Edwards or whatever, official files talking about what's going on at Area 51 or photographs and film footage, then they could be in danger. But right. the problem is, no one is in danger and the government is completely safe unless we have hard evidence of something. You know, it's like countless, arguably Roswell, you know, for whatever reason, could be the most significant UFO case in history. But people like Stanton Friedman or Don Schmidt haven't been silenced because they don't have any hard evidence. And the only thing, hard evidence, physical artifacts, you know, a bit of alien DNA, are the only things that will break this subject open.
Right.
You know, the reason why it stayed under the radar and the media don't take, or the scientific community haven't taken much notice for 64 years, is because we cannot present them with an alien body or a bit of wreckage. And until
right,
we can do that, things won't change.
I'm going to have to stop you there. Thank you very much. It's been a very interesting conversation. But I want you to have a couple of minutes before I announce next week's guest to let people know what your website address is and where they can get your books, because I know you've written a lot.
Okay, sure. Well, most of my books are available through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, etc. There's one or two of my early ones which are now out of print, but I think you can still get them as eBay or whatever, books like Covert Agenda and the FBI Files. And people can contact me at http://nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com.
Right, that was nickredfernsbooks.com.
Nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com.
Blogs.com. Okay, that's fine. Well, Nick, thank you again.
All right.
I've thoroughly enjoyed the last interview that we had. Today's was no exception. And I think you're doing some excellent work with your probing around. And I'm sure it must take you a lot of time after you've assembled all your facts to put it in a nice readable form in your book. But there you are. You obviously enjoy unearthing all these things and letting us know all about them. So thank you very much for coming onto the program, Nick.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Cheers.
You're welcome. Right, friends, that was a very interesting interview. Nick certainly has a lot of knowledge. Now, next week, I've got a lady, Betsy Thompson. She's also an author, but it's a subject that I've never had on before. So that'll make it a little bit different in as much that her last book is called Love Parent, and it's about the development of a child's spiritual growth and awareness and how you can be the parent you hope to be. So that's a little bit unusual, and I like the idea of someone giving us some advice, or giving would-be or actual parents advice on how to bring their children up and give them some measure of spiritual understanding or opportunity. So thank you for being with me today, and I hope you can make it next week. Thank you all very much. God bless you.